This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The question of amateurism and college athletics is back in the news after California passed the Fair Pay to Play Act. The law will allow student athletes in that state to profit from the use of their name, image, and likeness beginning in 2023. This change could have important implications for the multi-billion dollar industry that is college sports. Dwayne Ballin is here to help us understand the law and its impact. He's a sports journalist who has spent his career across multiple media networks covering college basketball, and he's here with us now. Welcome back, Dwayne.
Nice to be here, Frank. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. This Fair Pay to Play Act, what does it do? What does it not do?
Let's be clear on that. The law that Gavin Newsom signed in California, the governor there, what it does is it allows a student athlete now to go out individually, separate from the university, and market themselves, make names off their likeness, images, promotionally. So they can sign with agents now while they're at university, and they can utilize it, whether it's television commercials, camps, endorsements, autograph sessions. The law allows that to happen now. But what the law proscribes is that the university does not pay the athlete. This law is still not calling for direct compensation from the university to the athlete. It also indicates that the university can't take punitive measures. If an athlete goes out and does a deal with XYZ auto dealership in their town, the university can't take umbrage, and the university also cannot take the scholarship money or the stipend it gets for a cost of attendance and combine that with the income that that student would get from the said endorsement deal so that it balances off there. So that's separate. So the university is not required to pay the student athlete, but the student athlete has every right now to engage with a professional, an agent, and go out and to whomever is interested, market themselves and sell their image and likeness and control it while they are in school.
And why can they not do that now?
Well, the NCAA forbids all of that. Those go against their established laws of amateurism. So if you were to do that right now, you would be against the NCAA rules. But what we must remember is California is now law. That's a law. Law trumps the internal rules of any organization, even one as powerful and large as NCAA.
All right, and the now we're talking about is 2023, when it's scheduled to go into effect. And, of course, there is a little bit of debate over whether or not it's constitutional, whether or not a state has the right in these cases. And we'll get into that a little bit later on this program, because there is some question about whether, and I'm sure it'll be challenged, and I'm sure it'll be tested, no doubt, between now and 2023. But what kind of impact could this have?
It depends, Frank, upon the stakeholders along the continuum and what they decide to do. So if the law, if nothing else occurs between now and 2023, January 1st when the law goes into effect, the law will be a game-changing, landscape-altering piece of legislation. Because at that point, then student athletes will be able to do just what we said do. But it will also affect a lot of different things. It'll affect recruiting, because if California is still the only state at that time that has this law, you can imagine recruiting and the advantage it is going to give to the universities in California over universities anywhere else in the country.
Right.
And so there are a lot of coaches. I've talked to a number of coaches already and a number of people who are quite nervous about this advantage. Now, having said that, a lot can happen in the intervening time, because the NCAA, for one, formed a working group back in May that was supposed to look at this very matter. And the NCAA's Board of Governors meet later this month, October 28th and 29th in Atlanta, at which time they are to hear from that working group. Now, I can't imagine the NCAA is going to sit back and do absolutely nothing between now and 2023. Will their acts rise to the level of what the Fair Pay for Play Act is calling for? That's a good question. But it's hard to imagine that they won't do anything. And also, as you and I were talking earlier off air, there are at least 10 states already pushing some kind of legislation. There are a number of congressmen, including North Carolina's Mark Walker, who are putting together some kind of legislation to support this, to echo it. Now, if a federal statute were to be put on the books, then that obviates any state law. So therefore, you don't worry about it. Then it becomes the law of the entire land.
Right.
So a lot can happen. It's interesting to see. The NCAA, Frank, is in a position, if it so chooses, to act and get on board fast, because I think it's a rapidly moving story. But the NCAA also is an established conservative institution and a large institution.
And they've had a lot of power for a long time.
Right.
So they may choose not to give it up reluctantly, in which case they'll have it snatched from their hands. Because, as you say, you've got all of these, just in the California, these regions, these Pac-10, for instance, it's not just California teams. So if you're in their division, right, you're a team and you're in Washington State or you're in Arizona or you're in Oregon, and you're watching all these players starting now, waiting for 2023, all going to California, and you're going to play against them. I'm guessing legislators in those states are going to be the first ones on board.
Yeah, well, Arizona State's football coach, Herman Edwards, said immediately, I am very uncomfortable with the advantage that Stanford, Southern Cal, and UCLA will have, and Cal will have, against me recruiting kids. And that's why you see, I think, Washington is one of the very first states we mentioned that's moving fast towards this, because Washington is in that Pac-12 conference. So that's going to have a ripple effect across the country, because, believe me, the people in North Carolina, in Minnesota, the Midwest, and the South and the Northeast, none of the universities want to find themselves at a disadvantage, because it's something they completely cannot control. And they sense that, well, the California universities have something that no one else has, and that's not fair to us.
What did the NCAA say is the reason behind all of this, the reason for the rule and not allowing student-athletes to profit in any way from the image that certainly there is a great deal of profit to be made?
Oh, that's just historical philosophy on the NCAA's part. It goes back to the founding in 1905, when Teddy Roosevelt brought the university stakeholders together and founded the NCAA to look out for the health and betterment of college football. There was corruption then. There has always been this ideal that it was about the university mission in education, and that was the preeminent matter. So that's been a philosophical thing. And NCAA stuck to its amateurism for a long time. Now, obviously, there have been very clear examples of reality that have set in.
Well, corruption. There's been corruption writ large in the universities.
Right.
It wasn't the
And plus, you know, it's become, Frank, such a big economic enterprise now. Maybe 50 years ago, you could kind of stand halfway on one toe on that soapbox. But the truth is, when you have an enterprise that generates billions of dollars, the NCAA gets, and it has an $8.8 billion contract right now from Turner and CBS Sports for the men's basketball tournament. That's where they get all their revenue. They had revenue of $1 billion in 2018, the NCAA did. And coaches make seven figures across the country at the major level, football and basketball, men's basketball. So it's hard to look at your de facto workforce and say, well, you know, everybody gets something except for you.
We're talking about the future of amateurism in college sports today on The State of Things. Talking to Dwayne Ballen, sports journalist. How is the money distributed? Talk more about the way money is distributed in the NCAA program.
Well, I think it needs to be distinguished here, just so listeners understand. When they're watching college football in the playoffs, none of that money goes to the NCAA. College football formed the College Football Association in 1977. They broke off, and they started negotiating their own contracts. So the NCAA does not get any money at all from college football, but it gets money from the NCAA men's basketball tournament. That's where it gets its operating capital from. So what happens is they get that operating capital distributed to conferences, and conferences, through their media deals, are also distributing money to member institutions. That's one of the reasons why you've seen the proliferation of conference college networks. The Big Ten was the first one out there. Well, the Big Ten network generates around $50 million per school now, payout,
wow,
each year. So even if you're a school in the Big Ten that has not won a game all year in any sport, you're still going to get a $50 million or so check. And that's why you've seen this cascading of all these conferences, because the SEC conference is making money right away, and the ACC has jumped into it also.
Now, to be clear about this, the football programs have pulled away in terms of their financial deals,
right,
but they still operate
regulatory
under NCAA rules.
Right.
So those rules still apply to football,
right,
even though the revenues split up a different way.
Sure.
So give me an idea what you talked about the NCAA still being in some ways in the driver's seat if they decide to act proactively. What are some of the options that they might be looking at to mitigate what for them would be the pain of this law should it spread?
Well, ideally, I think if they look at it, they could look at the Fair Pay to Play Act and say, well, why don't we just adopt the tenets of that act and move forward, and we can modify it universally and all of our member institutions accept it. But the issue is that the co-chairs of that, their working committee, are Gene Smith, who's the director of athletics at Ohio State, and Val Ackerman, who is a Big East commissioner. Now, Gene Smith just said recently that if the law goes into effect, which it has in California, he doesn't see any other schools playing those schools in California because they're no longer part of the NCAA. Now, if he's part of the working committee saying that, that tells you that, well, then maybe they're not going to go as far as you think they should. They do have options, though. They can easily adopt all of these, or they can come back with a modified plan, you know, or they can sit back and wait for a federal statute to come into place. There are going to be lawsuits back and forth. I mean, some people arguing on the other side, it restricts interstate commerce, what mm-hmm. the law does. Others are saying, well, you know, it's all about restraint of trade.
Right.
So there are a number of things NCAA can do. I think the simplest thing for them to do would be to accommodate an across-the-board application of this law or something similar.
Dwayne Ballen, sports journalist. Dwayne, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation, the pros and cons of allowing amateur sports and amateur student athletes to profit at least by their image while they're in school. We'll talk more about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking about the Fair Pay to Play Act. It's a new law in California that is poised to transform the landscape of college athletics. The law would allow student athletes in that state to profit from the use of their names, image, and likeness. It begins in 2023. Kyle Cairo played as a defensive back for Northwestern University from 2013 to 2018, spent a year with the Dallas Cowboys. He's now a free agent, and he joins us now to give us his thoughts on the Fair Pay to Play Act and more. Welcome, Kyle.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing very well. I just wonder what your thoughts were when you saw that, in fact, the Fair Pay to Play Act was, in fact, signed into law and set to go into effect in 2023. What's your sense of that law and how it might work?
I think initially I was a bit excited. This is definitely something that's been on the topic of discussion in a lot of areas, especially as athletes. It's something that we've been debating, and I talked with some of my former teammates and even teammates at the time about the issue. And I think it's something that could really make waves, especially in the game of recruiting. However, how many students, athletes it'll actually affect every day, that is still up to speculation, I suppose.
Well, let's take a listen to this clip, because this is a clip of an interception that you made back in 2016, and I want to talk to you more about the impact of that. So let's listen to this, Northwestern versus Indiana. Let's have a listen.
Try to be accurate here downfield, and that throw is intercepted. Oh, what a play. Cairo with one hand going all Odell Beckham Jr.
So two hands wasn't an option. So why use two when you can use one? Look at him snag it out of the air.
That's a standout. Stand up. Stand and be counted. What an incredible interception.
That was a great pick. But let me explain to everybody what they just heard. That was on ESPN's Bleacher Report, other channels as well. I wonder if you saw that, because here it is. I mean, this is a moment that actually goes viral, right? I mean, this is 2016. We got plenty of platforms. And this could have been your moment to make a whole lot of money on just that pick. Were you able to make money? What are your thoughts on that?
Not only was I not able to make money, I honestly didn't even consider the possibility of making money at the time. It felt like, oh, wow, this is just a great play that occurred. And, you know, we got the win, and then it was like on to the next week. It wasn't even anything that really came to mind in terms of like being able to generate revenue from it. And I mean, after there was an explosion of social media and the play getting placed as the number one play on ESPN, which had always been a lifelong dream at the time. And it stayed there, maintained there for about a few, maybe 5 or 6 weeks after that, because I believe they put the number one plays against each other pretty often. So it was a great opportunity and just to be able to do it, but I never thought about it in terms of, you know, monetizing that moment.
Well, you know, Tim Tebow has talked about that as well. He played for Florida and played very briefly in the NFL. And he talks about the idea that, look, I'm playing for the school here. I'm not doing this for money. I'm not doing this for fame. I'm doing this for my university. Is that what athletes talk about? And when you're in the locker room in Dallas, is that pretty much what you heard?
Well, I think Tim has a good point, and I think it does pertain to a lot of athletes. So it can't be entirely discredited, but I think he may be missing part of the argument that, you know, there are people from different perspectives and upbringings than Tim. His family were lifelong Gator fans, his father and his grandfather, and to represent the university had always been a dream of his. And he got to accomplish that on the highest stage and did great things for sure. But there are a number of student athletes who, I guess, see this opportunity as one in order to make a name for themselves as well and to provide for their families. So they may not be coming from the same economic background as Tim, and obviously football and the money that it generates as a multi-billion-dollar business, they want a piece of that. So I think he may be missing out on it because he didn't necessarily see that as a need in terms of generating money. His priority at the time was playing football. So I think there's validity to his statement. I think he just also may be missing some of it as well, though.
I've also understood that you have some concerns about team dynamics should this law go into effect 2023 and the way it would play out in various locker rooms and clubhouses if this were to go into effect. Tell us more about that.
Right. So with the law going into effect, I think one thing that people may miss is that it may only affect a small percentage of the players on the team. Being able to generate and monetize yourself based off of your likeness is not necessarily always going to occur for everybody across the board. I don't think the long snapper of an institution is necessarily going to get the same amount of press as, you know, a star quarterback. And therefore, it may, similar to an NFL locker room, establish a hierarchy. And although, you know, student athletes on a team, for the most part, are experiencing the same day-to-day as athletes going to classes and all the things that you need to balance in between there, when you have some players who are making a significant amount more money than others, I think that may kind of change the landscape of an everyday locker room.
And you might also have a younger freshman coming in who's making that money, and the senior leadership, you know, maybe not at a point where they can make that kind of money. So you're suggesting that would be a bit of a challenge for the coach. Although I would think at the professional level, maybe the coaches have to face that every day now.
Right. I think at the professional level, there's kind of an expectation of it, especially when you're talking about first-round picks. But really, in the college game, it's similar because you have the recruiting, at least the environment around recruiting is so huge. You have all these different platforms where, you know, five stars and ranking systems, and along with that, kids are coming out of high school with a lot of name behind them. So that may change the way a team is broken down, just like you were saying.
Kyle Cairo, former Northwestern football player, spent a year with the Dallas Cowboys. He's now a free agent. Kyle, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I want to bring in two more voices to this conversation. Barbara Osborne is director of the Graduate Sport Administration Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Barbara, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Victoria Jackson, sports historian and former collegiate and professional runner. She teaches at Arizona State University now. Victoria, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Barbara, let me start with you. What's your reaction to the pay-for-play, the Fair Play Pay-for-Play Act, or now law?
Well, my reaction is basically that this is something that legislators should stay out of. College athletics is governed by the member institutions. It's a voluntary membership organization. And the rules that were put in place are there to benefit all student athletes and to guarantee that the enterprise can continue on. State legislatures like California that are, California implementing this basically says California schools don't have to follow NCAA rules anymore. And that completely changes the playing field.
But let me ask you, I mean, isn't this what legislatures do? I mean, particularly when it comes to things like fair pay. I mean, you wouldn't say the American Chamber of Commerce, which is a voluntary organization, could set the standard minimum wage. The United States government said, you know what, we're going to set a minimum wage. We know you don't like that.
Well, the difference is that nobody has to be a member of the NCAA. Schools choose to join the NCAA. And as a member of the NCAA, you choose to engage in the rule-making process, but also to follow those rules.
Victoria, let me ask you, you've written a lot about the NCAA and expanding rights for college athletes. What are your thoughts on this new law?
Yeah, thank you. Well, the schools make the rules. And so just, continuing the conversation that's been taking place, the schools make the rules. And the people behind this law have been working to try to restore rights to students who play sports to their names, images, and likeness for a long time. They've tried the courts. They're trying other ways. And, when Gavin Newsom signed the law, he said, we understand that this is probably – of all the possibilities of how this plays out, this law going into effect in 2023 is probably the least likely of those scenarios. And he said, we're pushing this because the NCAA and its member institutions aren't doing enough.
Well, let me stop you and ask you the question, though. If the schools make the rules and they've been pushing this long, why don't you get out of the NCAA and go ahead and make your rule? And this organization is stopping us. We think there should be something else. Leave and make your rule.
I'm a historian, right? So we can turn to points in history when this has taken place. Athletic scholarships used to be violations of amateurism. And a group of schools, mostly in the southern states, some in the ACC conference, where a lot of the Carolina schools exist, refused to stop giving scholarships. They couldn't compete with the other ways in which schools in the Midwest and Northeast were subsidizing their athletes. And so they forced it to a head. And there was a vote on whether or not to not play these schools, much like you're seeing right now, to put a boycott on those schools by the rest of the NCAA members. And ultimately, at the end of the day, they said, no, we're going to keep playing those schools. And what happened is just a few years later, the rules of amateurism, the form of subsidization on the clean side of the amateur line flipped. And then scholarships became NCAA-approved. And the way to subsidize your athletes because of this coming to a head. So I think there's a good lesson in that history for what we're seeing today.
Barbara, you mentioned, you talked about a sort of a principled argument against this. Legislature shouldn't be doing this. It's a voluntary organization. They make the rules. What about the issue involved? Should the NCAA take a look at this? Should athletes somehow receive compensation, student athletes?
Well, student athletes are receiving compensation, as Victoria just mentioned. Not only do they receive tuition, but they also receive books, fees, room, board, and now cost of attendance. And that's more than any academic scholarship person or student at an institution would have. But the intangibles that the athletes are receiving, besides that monetary compensation, is invaluable across their lifetime. And nobody's really talking about how much it costs to provide those athletes with those opportunities.
What are the intangibles or what?
Oh, well, there's research that comes actually out of our program that shows that student-athlete earnings over their lifetime, not taking professional athletes out of the equation, but student-athlete former student-athletes earn more across their lifespan than the average student coming from the same institution. Also, employers are much more interested in hiring former student-athletes because of the things that you learn through competition on the playing fields are different than the things that you can just learn in a classroom.
Victoria Jackson, what about that? Student-athletes are already being compensated.
Yes, well, that's true. And they are not, their compensation has not risen alongside the dramatic exponential growth in this enterprise, even if we just look at the last 15 years alone. This system has increased from $4 billion a year to $14 billion a year. And so, yes, you know, athletes have, thanks to actually Kyle Kiro's teammate, Kane Coulter, and his unionization effort at Northwestern, the benefits to athletes have increased, as well as cost of attendance stipends. But that is not on pace with everybody else who's making money in this. And the bloating that we're seeing, just as one example, Alabama football has a staff of 45 people, and there's three former Division I college football head coaches in analyst roles right now. As far as the other topic of how athletes are benefiting from this and they're getting so much out of this experience, yes, some of them are. I was one of those athletes. I'm a beneficiary of collegiate amateurism. But if we drill into the various sports, and especially within the Power Five, there's a bifurcated experience taking place in intercollegiate athletics. My work looks at how black athlete labor pays for white athlete privilege. It's people like me who went to wealthy public high schools, who could play country club sports, and then go on to college and have the skills and resources to balance academic and athletic responsibilities, who thrive in this system. But the money that's generated that pays for it all is, you know, made by people who are spending upwards of 50 to 60 hours a week on sport and don't have the time to take advantage of, you know, embracing both academic and athletic excellence while they're in school. So, you know, we were all promised this world-class education, but only athletes like me can really truly enjoy it and embrace it if we're really being honest about it all.
We are talking about the future of amateur sports today on The State of Things. Talking with Victoria Jackson, sports historian, and Barbara Osborne, UNC professor in sports administration. Yes, Barbara.
Oh, I really wanted to respond back that I really, truly disagree that it's a few. I think that all student athletes in all sports are putting in that same time and effort. It's not not just a few that are putting in those kinds of hours, and also that the problem really comes from where people value education.
But there's a lot of question about whether or not student athletes, particularly in the high profile programs, the ones who are actually putting in the time, because I think Victoria will tell you. In fact, Victoria, I'll ask you, were you putting in as much time because I think you're using yourself as an example, that you
Sure.
didn't spend that much time on sports in your particular sport as maybe the high-profile football and basketball players whose expectations are much higher.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I never spent more than 20 hours a week on my sport. I got to, you know, experience what college was all about. I played in the orchestra. I changed my major to history because I fell in love with history while I was an undergraduate student at the University of North Carolina. And then that enabled me to turn pro in both school and sport. I went on to Arizona State University, where I earned my PhD and won a national championship and turned pro. But I think what I'd like to see, I'm positive, I'm optimistic, I love college sports. I think we in higher education can do better, and name, image, and likeness is, I see an opportunity in it to kind of open the door and do better to serve all our students who play sport, particularly, you know, beyond, you know, earning more compensation, but also getting creative around what athlete education means. If we, for example, you know, by kind of teasing out the amateur parts and keeping the education parts, what we in higher education do best, we can get really creative about what athlete education looks like. We can take seriously the performative art of playing football. We can help athletes, you know, enhance their brands. And then after they go pro, when they're retired at, you know, 27 or 28, we can welcome them back to our universities because we can also offer them lifetime scholarships in this model.
What?
I think we can really get creative in this space.
Barbara, I think you also had more to say, so I want to let you finish that thought that you began. And, you know, about the future, because I'm thinking, too, there have been so many scandals around athlete education at UNC Chapel Hill in particular where students were being essentially robbed of their education, and that scandal was unfolded, and I'm sure UNC was not alone in that. Can we really believe that these student-athletes, are particularly the high-profile ones, are getting an education?
The onus of any student that goes to school is to get an education. You could have been a high school valedictorian, come to college, party all the time, fail out of everything, and be done because you didn't value your education. There are people that come from disadvantaged backgrounds that did not have access to the same things that wealthy school systems can provide for their students, who succeed beyond their wildest dreams in college and university because they put the effort in and they want to.
But I wonder if the recruiting for those high-profile athletes really emphasizes the education.
It depends on the coach. There are lots of coaches. I mean, at UNC, we have football players that have gone on to medical school. We have football players that have careers in really lucrative areas, and their education was valued. They cared. We've also had football players who the only thing they wanted to do was play in the NFL and did the bare minimum that they possibly could to stay eligible. And if you're going to major in eligibility, you get out of it what you put into it.
Victoria Jackson, if I were to give you just 20 seconds to reply to that, what would you say?
Oh, well, again, you know, it's a performative art. So I don't see somebody who wants to take seriously playing a professional sport, they shouldn't feel guilty about that. We should embrace that and, again, get creative around how we can enhance the education around that. And also welcome folks back.
Victoria Jackson, sports historian, former collegiate professional runner, now teaches at Arizona State. Barbara Osborne, director of graduate sports administration at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Live music coming up. Reese Palmer, stay with us.